You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show. This is The Brian Callen. This is Conversations with Brian Callen, Hunter Mott.
Brian Callen and some other dude.
Rebecca, we can't figure out a good name. Just can't. Good.
Yeah.
But our guest is Rebecca Jeske. She is, what is your, you're the media relations director, I think, and an analyst for the Electric Frontier Foundation.
Electronic.
And, the electronic, not the electric.
Yeah.
That's an underground group I belong to. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF. This is, I think, your 30th anniversary?
Coming up on the 25th year,
25th
right?
Year,
that's next
yeah.
year, right?
Yep. Next year we'll be 25 years old.
And you essentially defend the rights of freedom on the internet. I mean, it's all about freedom of expression and keeping Big Brother at bay. I mean, I'm being a little dramatic here, but talk about what the Electronic Frontier Foundation is, how it started, and then we'll get into some fun stuff here.
Yeah, I don't think you're being dramatic at all. we're really concerned with preserving free speech on the internet, privacy in all our digital devices, but we're also really concerned with, you know, innovation and the next big thing. You know, 5 years ago, we didn't know that Twitter would be so important and all these other, tools that we have would be so important. So we want to make sure that the legal landscape and the cultural landscape is there for the next cool thing that we don't even know about, and that our free speech rights and our privacy rights are protected while we're doing that.
Mm, great. Thank God, by the way, because it seems I just get this feeling that one of the things that I think The Economist ran an article about the America that works, and it was really about e-commerce and just how that is a true marketplace. And one of the great things about podcasting, we talk about this all the time, is I can say what I want when and how and interview who I want. And you know, I know that Joe Rogan and Adam Carolla and Mark Maron and all the guys like that feel the same way and talk about it. But there are threats out there. Like with anything, you've got government bodies and agencies that want to somehow regulate e-commerce. They want to regulate the internet. And sure, a lot of the motives are, I suppose, usually couched in good intentions.
Yeah, but so were Hitler's.
Right. I mean, and this is what we have to worry about. So I'd like to touch on the podcast trolls. I'd like to touch on Snowden's case and all these things and where you guys stand on all that.
Absolutely. So the podcasting patent issue is really important. And I actually think it segues just a little bit into net neutrality, which is something I'd like to talk about a little bit too. You had a lot of really high profile podcasters, along with some really small podcasters that were getting demand letters out of the blue. And I think you really hit the nail on the head with sort of the freedom that people have with podcasting. You don't have the FCC telling you what you can say and what you can't say and what time of day you can say it. You're really allowed to be yourself and do your thing and really express.
Yeah, imagine that. Imagine that.
No, exactly. Right? I mean, you know, the FCC is trouble, which is why the net neutrality thing is so problematic. But then, you know, you get this thing in the mail saying, you are podcasting, you are infringing on my patent, and you owe me X dollars, or I'm going to take you to court.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is that the people like Adam Carolla pushed back right away,
right.
and said no. I mean, usually when you get a letter like that, it's scary. I mean, you might not have the money, so you either stop doing your thing, which is a horrible shame, or you pay up. But fortunately, a lot of really high profile people fought back, and we here at EFF filed a petition at the Patent and Trademark Office challenging this patent, which is ridiculous.
Who was behind this? A bunch of scumbag lawyers or one guy?
You know, the podcasting patent is owned by Personal Audio. And, you know, there's all sorts of different ways that people are patent trolls. I actually don't know what kind of patent troll Personal Audio is, but the idea is instead of, you know, making money off your patent by using it and licensing it properly, you make money by extorting people.
Bad guys. Bad people. Yeah.
It works in Sicily. Why shouldn't it work in America?
Well, I know a lot of small businesses were getting letters like this just out of the blue. Like you'd own a mom and pop shop and they'd say, you know.
Yeah. And it's not just podcasting patents, right? You know, there were people getting them for scanning to PDF. You know how like a big, you know, like a nice big copier, you can scan it and it'll email you a PDF.
Yeah.
And people were getting letters saying, you own technology that lets you scan to PDF, so you owe us X amount of money. And it's just a third company entirely.
Amazing.
It's ridiculous.
And they make money that way.
Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead. But people are fighting back.
Well, we don't really know who's behind this, or we do. It's probably a group of people or one guy or
name names, Rebecca. Name names.
Well, it's a company called Personal Audio, and they absolutely are fighting our challenge to the patent. We've had a number of court battles with them and their lawyers, and they at one point asked us we're doing a campaign around this podcasting patent, trying to spread the word and help to fight it. And at one point, they asked for the names of all of our donors, which was something that we fought back against.
Do they have a claim? Did they actually invent this technology?
No. We have, what you do when you challenge a patent is you find prior art, which is a legal term for examples of this stuff used before that.
Mm, okay.
Before they patented it. And so we found a ton of prior art.
Right.
And of course, people podcast in all sorts of different ways. I mean, there's no technology they're talking about. They're talking about a concept, which is, I think, the really hard part to understand,
It's amazing. It's amazing. And they actually think they're going to win this. How is it going? How is the struggle and the fight going?
Well, it's going really well. So last month, an appeal board at the patent office found that that we here at EFF had a reasonable likelihood of prevailing.
Great.
So
awesome.
So that's good news. But it's still, a lot of people paid up. This is a huge pain, right? We're doing this as part of our.
So they've already. So Personal Audio has already made money off these things.
I don't know how many times that they might have cashed in, but you have to assume that some people just paid.
Yeah, not me.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't.
That's because, Brian doesn't have any money from doing this podcast.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's because, more importantly, it's just because we're just too smart for them to listen to.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
They're like, oh, well, you guys have authors and people like Rebecca on? Forget it.
I think that's the interesting thing is that, it's it's not just that these people have, filed a spurious claim. It's also that they've wasted so many people's time. Like the ability to, either way, like Mark Maron and Adam Carolla and Joe and all these people have wasted their time. And, you guys have had to devote energy to this rather than, things like net neutrality or whatever else it is. I mean, it's so easy for...
It doesn't surprise me, though. Yeah. You're always going to have opportunists, and it's kind of like punching the ocean. I don't know what they think they're doing. I mean, I invented the internet. You don't see me jumping up and down. So Rebecca, let's talk about net neutrality.
Yeah. So, this is such a tough one. Right now, the FCC has a comment period about its new proposed rules to allow some internet providers to provide better access to some websites. It's a kind of a pay to play thing. This is deeply problematic for all sorts of reasons. If we allow providers now to engineer the internet to let the big guys go faster, whether that's Netflix or Facebook or something else, then we're not going to get the new Netflix or Facebook or something else. We're going to code in what we have now, and we're not going to get the new cool thing. I mean, the amazing thing about the internet is it's a true marketplace of ideas. The cool thing rises to the top, no matter who's backing them. And
that's why you got kids who are 21 becoming billionaires. It's just a, it's an amazing, it's a frontier. It's a true marketplace. Exactly. It's a marketplace of ideas the way it should be.
Maybe that's why you guys are called the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Hello.
It is, in fact. I can get to that story too.
Yeah. So I would imagine that Netflix and Facebook and some of these bigger companies are lobbying for that law, or how is this happening?
Actually, interestingly, a lot of the big companies are against it as well.
Okay.
Which is good news, right? I think part of that is because there's still a startup culture at a lot of these places. And the other is, if there's a pay-to-play system, they're going to have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Like, you know, so it's truly problematic. But, you know, another thing that I think is really important is, you know, as these are all really tough questions, and people talk a lot about how they might want someone to regulate. But I think it's really important to think about, do we really want the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, to be interfering with the internet?
No.
right? We've seen what the FCC has done to television.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the big problem here, I mean, you know, we've got a website at dearfcc.org where people can go on and send their comments to the FCC about this specific proposal. But I one thing that I think people should really keep in mind during this debate is, be careful about advocating for the FCC to take more control, even if you think it's for a good thing.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because that's opening the door
to some
real problems.
Yeah, another bigger government agency? Huh. No thanks. Like the Department of Energy or the Department of Agriculture or the Department, I mean, how's that, or how's the Department of Education? How's that all going for us so far? Great job, guys.
I know. And worse, I mean, the FCC does love to regulate content.
Yes, they do. That's what government is in the business of they're coercive, right? I mean, the government, you need some government, but government's job is to tax and to legislate.
And this is,
to pass laws and take your money. I mean, you need some laws and you need some taxation, but that is what government does, and government throughout history, if you let it continue to grow, will keep doing that.
And that's the thing, is the interesting thing is, Lawrence Lessig, who was on your board for a long time and was really focused on, you know, all of these issues before he started focusing on campaign finance, essentially both of these issues are really about erosions of free speech, right? If you don't have net neutrality, then essentially the big guys get to speak louder. And if you have campaign finance, then the big guys get to speak louder. Mm-hmm. You're able to, it's you start to get where the people who don't have money can no longer amplify their voice, and so they're going to get drowned out.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and I actually think they're connected in another way, which is that one of the issues when you have a big government organization regulating something is you have issues of regulatory capture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have people that go back and forth between commissions and the private sector. And really buy into the private sector. So that's always a big problem when you have these commissions that are supposed to regulate an organization, and yet people are leaving that commission to go get a nice big lobbying job.
You mean kind of like the Japanese Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that also all of those people then went and worked for the Fukushima nuclear power plant? You mean that's a problematic system?
So crazy.
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
And Larry Lessig can tell you again and again about how this all happens.
Capitol Hill is a farm team for the pros. That is, the lobby is K Street, the lobbyist down on K Street. On Capitol Hill for $120,000 a year or whatever it is for 8 years. Make your contacts and then come over to K Street. And now you'll be a lobbyist for our company and make five times that much by essentially using your influence to get large companies who've got the money to pay for it a step up, an advantage in the marketplace. That's where Lessig says we're losing our republic.
So how do we? I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, one of the things that obviously, because Brian and I podcast, we meet a lot of people through the podcast. We talk to them, and you know, certain themes start to come out. Right, it very much seems like what the EFF is doing with net neutrality is very much like what Lawrence Lessig is now doing with campaign finance. Essentially, there's a whole cluster of issues that are really around the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. And how is it that we begin to build consensus where people start to realize, oh, everywhere free speech is under attack, and this is how we recognize what is an attack on free speech and what is not, and are able to start making some real demands about protecting our First Amendment rights?
Well, you know, I actually think it's started, and we're doing a great job. We just need to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in Congress already have you know, really heard. I mean, I think a great example of sort of understanding, you know, how the First Amendment plays into things that you might not think are about the First Amendment was the SOPA PIPA fight of a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
So that was, you know, you might remember, I think it was like 2 years ago, maybe the internet blacked out for a day because of these bad laws that were pending in Congress. And they were sort of Hollywood-backed laws that they'd been trying to get into place for a long time that would involve the ability to censor entire websites if they might have infringing content on them.
Right.
Copyrighted content. And the problem with that is that there are always a million ways where you can use copyrighted material that's legal.
Right.
For parody, fair use, this is all, like, you know, really important stuff. And in fact, corollary Lessig stuff before he moved on to political reform. And, you know, in the 21st century, we have to be able to quote, to do a parody of something in order to comment. Yeah, and the internet really understood that when people started doing this activism against these bills that were really going to involve, you know, censoring web pages when Hollywood gave their say so, because they didn't like the way their content might be being used. You know, there were these mass protests, you know, shut down the phone lines in Washington, and, you know, to this day we hear staffers tell us, oh, you know, my employer doesn't want to get SOPA PIPA'd again. We don't want to get the internet to
That's
hate us.
That's awesome.
Again.
That is pretty awesome, by the way.
It's really wonderful. I mean, you know, and one of the architects of that whole protest was Aaron Swartz, the poor guy who took his own life after being, you know, unfairly prosecuted by the government.
There have been some high profile cases. Schwartz kind of made, I think, MIT's files, a lot of the academic files and papers, free, available to anybody who
It was more than just MIT. Yeah, it was basically JSTOR, which is a database for academic papers.
Right.
And they basically...
But MIT, I think, was the one who could have lifted the charges or gone through the prosecution.
Well, he did it through MIT. Okay. Like, he basically went through MIT's system and I think used their, essentially, in inverted commas, login.
But there is, Rebecca, sort of... I mean, when there is something to be said for protecting intellectual property... you know what I mean? So if you're a professor and you've written this paper and it's taken you 20 years or 10 years, whatever it might be, and people, students have to pay something to get to that information, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And when somebody, an independent player, comes along and says, hey, here's your life's work, everybody, it's free, I can kind of understand where that would, you know, that's not so cool.
Well, the interesting part there, though, is it wasn't the professors who were getting paid. It was the system.
It was JSTOR. I mean, that's the point.
The professors often get federal funding for research for their papers, and they don't actually get paid for people downloading it from this.
But JSTOR is still a company that was started by somebody who had a good idea, and they should be able to profit from that, from their idea. I mean, right? I mean, JSTOR is a good idea. People use it. Somebody came up with that idea. They probably got very rich on it.
Well, it may be an outdated idea is the problem. You know, I mean,
But that's not for, that's not for one person like Eric Schwartz to decide to come and go, I'm going to bust open your vault here, you know.
And that certainly was a decision that the courts could have made. But, of course, instead the feds were saying that he was going to have 80 years in prison for a hacking charge.
Yeah.
They weren't actually. He wasn't charged with the copyright crime. He was charged with federal
hacking. But I think a lot of these guys, these feds and stuff, are, you know, not very computer savvy. I mean, my buddy Mike Casantini, who produces this show, who's sitting here now, he's been ahead of the game. Like, he'll come up with these things, and I'll be like, I don't know what you're talking about, and I ignore it. And then he comes back to me 3 years later. He's like, remember when I was telling you about applications? You know what applications are? Well, that's kind of – that's something that – I mean, and so there are certain people that are on the internet, like my buddy Mike, who is so far ahead of the game. And most people, like law enforcement, probably have no idea what they're dealing with when they get a hacker like this. And they go, first of all, we can't control it. Second of all, there are a lot of people like this out there, and we got to make an example of this guy, or it's going to be a free-for-all. So in that sense, I sympathize, I think, with law enforcement. And
there's also a real culture clash. I mean, if you're
there
in
is
law,
a culture
yeah,
clash.
Because if you're in law enforcement, then you're about enforcing, you know, sort of very traditional ways of thinking about things.
Yeah, and if you're Mike Casantini, you tend to like your weed.
Yeah,
I said it out loud. Sorry.
You like busting down doors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And thank God, by the way, that's part of like you were saying. I mean, it should be a marketplace of ideas. We should have innovative people, but I do think that there are hacking laws, aren't there? I mean,
the hacking laws are actually pretty bad. And in fact, it is one of the reasons why EFF got started in the first place back in 1990. There were three people, Mitch Kapor, John Gilmore, and John Perry Barlow, who is a lyricist for the Grateful Dead, among other things, were hanging out on The Well, which was an online bulletin board. And
it already sounds incredibly subversive. Keep going. they probably have a hacky sack among them, and they're just kicking it back and forth. Jeez. Communists! All right, keep going.
They're all great guys. Two of them are still on our board of directors. And they their big concern, actually, in the beginning was that kids who were experimenting with the internet were being overcharged. That they were doing the equivalent of breaking into a computer system and sort of spray painting on a wall and running away, and then they were facing decades and decades in prison, which is still going on today.
Wow.
You know, the Aaron Swartz thing was an example of that, and we still see cases where people are getting overcharged, and lots of times I do think it's people genuinely misunderstanding, whether it's the judge or the prosecutor, exactly what's going on. So that is one of our core reasons to be here at ESF, is to really make sure that the courts and the prosecutors and the cops understand how this technology works, to make sure it's fair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, what Brian was talking about in terms of another sort of big fundamental issue, it's the First Amendment, but it's also intellectual property. And any society makes a decision about how much it defends intellectual property rights, because if you give people intellectual property rights indefinitely, then that becomes a monopoly on those ideas, and that really is, you know, going to destroy innovation. But
intellectual property rights are property rights, right? I mean, it's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's a fundamental difference in the sense that if you buy a house, you can own it indefinitely.
Yeah.
As opposed to, we've made the decision that if you have come up with an idea, then you'll own it for 20 years. Because we understand that innovation is about taking old ideas and tweaking them.
Right.
So you want to re-inject those ideas back into the system to be able to be innovated upon. Because ultimately, we all benefit from living in the benefits that come from your idea being reused and improved are greater than the benefits that you would get from just holding on to that idea forever.
Right.
Yeah, and certainly intellectual property rights are important. I mean, you know, I'm a writer. You know, when I write something for ESF, it's under a Creative Commons license, and anyone can publish that, and I want that to be true. But, you know, I also do other stuff in my own time, and I don't want people to steal and put their name on what I do.
Sure.
And but that isn't really what about here. We need to make sure that that intellectual property law that protects legitimate rights doesn't go too far. So it's
You're talking about proportion. You're talking about proportion.
It's a trade-off, and I think that's the question, is where does that trade-off lie? I mean, if we know that essentially a patent of a million years would be bad for the society, and we know that a patent of 0 years would be bad for the society, where is that sweet spot? Is it 20 years? And is 20 years something that made sense when innovation was only happening at a certain rate in the 1900s? Should it be less? I mean, should it be different for different things? I mean, if you're talking about, for example, pharmaceuticals, the time that it takes to develop a drug, the time it takes to get a drug to market, I mean, that's getting shorter, but it's still much more time-consuming.
12 years or something, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how do we know where that line should be, and should it be the same across all intellectual domains or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear it shouldn't be across all of them. I mean, you know, it's one of the things we're pushing here at EFF is patent reform. We're not calling to abolish patents. They're an important part of, you know, American innovation. But there's some common sense things that we can do to make sure that it's not just about lawyers fighting each other and people getting these crazy demand letters.
Right. So what are those sorts of things?
Well, a lot of the common sense reform is that believe it or not, people can get damages. Mm-hmm. So if you fight this, you can actually have your attorney's fees paid. Could you imagine going through? I mean, you know, one of the reasons why we can do this is because we can fight this podcasting patent is we're this nonprofit, you know, that can go do it. If you had to hire top of the line lawyers to fight this patent, it would just be astronomical. Mm. I mean, a single, you know, maybe we could get like Mark Cuban to back us and fund the whole thing, but it would have to be that sort of like massive amount of money.
Yeah.
If people who failed at enforcing their patents had to pay attorney's fees, then suddenly they've got some skin in the game.
Right, exactly.
So that's a really important
that. Yeah, that's a very important. If you sue me, you should have to pay my lawyer fees when you lose, you know.
Right. And so that's going to really discourage trollish behavior.
Let's talk a little bit about Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning. I guess he got a sex change in jail. Julian Assange and then finally Edward Snowden. Where do you guys stand on Julian Assange and people like Snowden and Private Manning, who's now, I think, doing 35 years in prison? I mean, these are difficult cases, aren't they?
Yeah, they're difficult, and I think it's really hard to group them all together.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because they're all really different things, although, you know, maybe, you know, part of this. Part of all the things that we've learned in the last, you know, 5 years about American government activities, what Edward Snowden did has been extraordinarily important over the last year. I mean, these are things that many of us in the activism community have suspected. In the legal community, you know, we'd been litigating against this surveillance since 2006, but we hadn't had any real documents.
Right. We knew that we were being spied on, basically, which is illegal technically. I mean, the FBI is allowed to, after with a search warrant or certain warrants, allowed to spy on its own citizens. But certainly intelligence agencies like the CIA and DIA are not really. They're supposed to spy on foreign agents, not on their own people. Right.
That's right. And they're certainly not supposed to dump everybody's communications into a big server farm in Utah for when they want to, like, look through it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the whole point.
But I mean, I can't believe the U.S. government or any government would actually overstep its bounds. This is crazy. I trust them, and I love Mark Twain's. I'm not a liberal. I'm not a bleeding heart liberal. I'm a libertarian, I guess is the best way to put it, but I just believe in the Constitution in this country. But, you know, Mark Twain said, a loyalty to my country always, to my government only when it deserves it. I mean, that's a great distinction.
It is a great distinction. And even though, you know, here at EFF we've been fighting the government on various things basically since the very beginning. But a lot of the Snowden paperwork that, you know, and the records that we saw shocked people here. Really, really shocked people.
You guys didn't realize the extent to which the government was overstepping its bounds.
Yeah, and I think the real shock here, because so many people here are attorneys, is how they were just freely interpreting the law and just lying about it.
Well, what is the blowback now? I mean, we've embarrassed a lot of it is, and you know, we find that Angela Merkel's been spied on and et cetera, et cetera. So the intelligence agencies were somewhat embarrassed. But did Barack Obama know about this stuff?
I don't know, but he had to, personally. I think he must have. I mean, I don't know how he couldn't have.
Yeah.
But it's pretty amazing how they secret reinterpretations of the law where words don't mean what they mean.
Yeah,
you know, collection
right.
means something else. I mean, that's, I think, the part that really chilled people around here. Because if the law doesn't mean anything and you can make words mean whatever they want, then then we're in a whole new place.
Yeah. I think the important thing to realize is that that's how most of us would probably behave if we had a job to do. That if you create that incentive structure, just know, I think the default should always be, listen, any government agency has a job to do. The CIA and all these agencies have good people working for them, not bad people. But and I'm sure including NSA, et cetera, et cetera. But they got a job to do. And there's a lot of pressure to get that job done. There's a lot of pressure to keep America safe. There's a lot of pressure to know a lot of things, to have answers. And so most of us would probably, if we could, you know, not bend the law, but at least interpret it differently. That's human. And I think that's a very, very important thing to keep in mind whenever you create a government agency. Know that that's going to be the case. And that's why you need, you know, the people like, you know, your organization, the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the whole point of checks and balances. You know, if you give people absolute power, they will become corrupted. And it has nothing to do with them being bad people. It's just that power goes to people's heads. That's Look at Kim Kardashian. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Wait a minute.
Well, and you know, and that was one of the big issues here is that because everything was secret and they were going to secret courts for secret reinterpretations, there weren't the checks and balances. One of the proposals, which so far hasn't gotten anywhere in Congress, which is too bad, is to have an advocate inside the NSA or other intelligence agencies whose job it is to advocate for the privacy of American people. So they have that that opposition internally.
That's a tough job. That's a tough job for anybody. I can just see that. Oh, boy.
Yeah. I think it would be hard for that person not to be captured, sort of what we talked about before. But, you know, the idea that you at least have an adversarial process with somebody saying, you know, here's what
kind of like internal affairs in police, you know,
police.
But I, you know, the good news also, though, I think part of the American character is to constantly question authority and to know that government should be treated like a necessary evil, not some giant engine to solve all your problems.
Well, not everybody feels like that.
No, but I'm saying that if you look at young people today, most people have a healthy distrust of any kind of secret government body. I think in some ways to our detriment, you know, people are like, well, there are too many. I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I don't like that so much. But there's no question that, you know, the Snowden case exposed what would have made for a pretty good Hollywood movie. People were very surprised.
It did make for a good Hollywood movie, didn't it? I'm sure
They're making one actually about Snowden. So
is it true they want Brian Callen to star?
I'm too athletic looking. I don't look. My back is too broad.
Yeah.
But what is my posture too straight? I don't have.
But maybe
that.
They're going to make it into an action movie where Snowden just like rips in with a RPG.
I like
and,
that
like,
idea.
Blows the
like
shit out
idea.
Of the NSA.
He's just got really fast fingers. I've almost got it. I don't. What is the? So what do you think is going to happen with Snowden? In 10 years, is he going to be looked at as a
hero? Is he still going to be in Moscow?
Mm. Well, you know, that's tough. I mean, the whole like extradition and what laws he broke and didn't break, that's a whole area of law that we don't specialize in. And there's some really good people in Washington who work on that kind of thing, which is great because it's a little outside of our sphere. I mean, I personally believe that in 10 years he'll be looked at the way that Daniel Ellsberg is looked at now. The guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers. I mean, this has just been, you know, his leaks were groundbreaking, and you know, and that's sort of what we've been focusing on in EFF is that, you know, the information that we have now is so important. We need to do, you know, our part, the legal part.
Who did he leak that information to first? Snowden.
The Guardian, right?
Yeah. I don't remember who he got to first, if it was Glenn Greenwald or Laura Poitras. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was interesting that he really leaked things in a different way than Chelsea Manning did.
Yeah, I was going to ask you the difference between Chelsea Manning and formerly Bradley Manning.
Yeah, that. So the way that
by the way, makes a very cute man and a cute woman, by the way. So, I mean, he's kind of a cutie pie. I'm just going to say.
He's spoiled for choice.
Yeah, he's a cutie. I mean, I don't even know if he hadn't needed a sex change. He kind of looks wonderfully sort of androgynous. So good on you. Anyway.
But Snowden really, you know, brought all these things to journalists and had them, like, sift through and find, you know, help him find the most important stuff and help, you know, connect with technologists and the right journalists to write these stories. The documents that WikiLeaks got from Private Manning was sort of a giant dump. I mean, I don't know if you read some of those cables that came out, that a lot of them weren't didn't seem critical at all. I mean, I remember reading a detailed cable about a wedding in the Caucasus that was fascinating, but
right. it had nothing to do with anything. Yeah,
right. It had nothing to do with anything except slightly embarrassing to the person whose wedding it was, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a difference. There was a difference there, and you know what WikiLeaks did in publishing all those cables, you can decide whether they were, I mean, there are lots of different opinions about whether they made the right journalistic decision to print them all or not. But the really important part about WikiLeaks was what they were doing was journalism, whether you thought it was good journalism or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the, to us, the really scary part about the debate around WikiLeaks and those documents. The scary part was saying that somehow WikiLeaks had broken the law when what they were really doing is journalism, and you don't want people to criminalize journalism.
You don't. But the only issue can be that if there is information, especially intelligent information that could put American law enforcement,
but
and
how do you make that decision
at risk?
I mean, you can always
decision is the following. I mean, when you're working undercover. And somebody
sure.
blows your cover, man. I mean,
like Valerie Plame, right?
Yeah,
right.
But even worse, because Valerie Plame was more of an analyst. I mean, when there are guys out there with their boots on the ground, they're up close and personal. And if they get caught by the wrong guy, or they get their cover, or more importantly, not only the Americans, but their assets, our assets, they get killed, or worse, you know. And that's where we have to be careful with this stuff. And that's where I can understand if you're an intelligence operative and you're putting your life at risk, or a military guy, you know, you'd be less than sympathetic to somebody like Manning, who was that indiscriminate about just dumping a bunch of information. I think that's a little bit irresponsible. And look, he's doing 35 years for a reason, right? I mean,
well, and you know, and WikiLeaks did actually do some redactions, but I think, but another the flip side of that is, you know, the New York Times held on to the first story about the warrantless wiretapping that came out in 2005 after the election, held on to that story for a full year because the government had told them they would put people at risk. You know, the story was killed at the LA Times before that because there's actually a clash. Different people say different things. The editors at the LA Times say that the story wasn't ripe. The writer of the story says that it was killed because of government pressure. So you know, that's the flip side of it, is that we have seen lots of pressure for saying you can't publicize this, you're going to put people at risk, when it was information that the American public needed. So
did Manning and Snowden, do we know, did they know that they were going to get caught doing this stuff?
I don't know about Manning. I mean, Snowden had to know, right? That's why he left the country, that he had a plan,
right,
to put himself out there. I don't know about Manning.
Yeah.
I mean, I have been following the Snowden stuff more closely because it's just so core to what we do here.
It's probably a complicated thing. It's probably a bigger answer than that anyway. I mean, you know, I don't know, but and again, they're two very different people. But let's go back to Julian Assange for a second. What is your take on Assange? Is Assange, you know, what is he? Is he a guy who is he just this wildly ambitious man who wanted to do something nobody else was doing? Is he a seeker of the truth? I mean, where do you guys fall on that? Or maybe you don't have to have an opinion about it.
Yeah, you know, it's hard because, you know, for us, we're interested in the First Amendment implications of publishing information on the internet, which is at heart what Julian Assange did. At heart, he was a journalist who got a leak, who got leaked information, and he made decisions like an editor might about what to publish, and then he did it. And that's the important part. I think, you know, for me personally, I don't like to get too into, you know, should he, I don't like to get into too much about him because everything that I've personally found out about him, I don't like him very much as a person. But it doesn't, you know, so it seems to make sense for me, you know, to, I mean, and I think that's important to know when you go, you know what, I'm not going to make judgments on this person as a person, but as journalism. And it was very concerning to me when you have, you know, people in Congress saying, you know, I think Julian Assange should be in prison, when you're like, well, then who else are you going to throw in prison?
Well, and that's the interesting, I mean, I think you raise a really interesting issue, which is that, you know, Snowden, Manning, and Assange are all, on a personal level, polarizing figures. Like, there are people, for each of their separate reasons, people feel uncomfortable with what they did. And it's so easy for that to influence how people assess their actions. You know what I mean? And I think it's so important, like, let's forget who the people were who did it, and let's just look at whether the action is right or is not, you know, and talk about basically, you know.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
You know.
It's almost less, it's not relevant. You're right. What's relevant, is, as you said, is the First Amendment and sort of the fact that the government was stepping out of its jurisdiction, out of its bounds, was breaking the law, essentially. And they got... they got exposed by these three people. You usually need probably an extreme profile or at least an unorthodox profile to do this kind of stuff.
But
I mean, they throw their lives into, you know, they go to jail. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly takes a certain psychology.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me because I, you know, when you think it through, I mean, how many people would ditch their entire lives? You know, Snowden left his girlfriend at her, you know, at their house.
Wow.
And left,
yeah.
You know, and had to have known that there was a very real possibility that he would never come back to the U.S. or never see his friends and family again. I mean, I personally am not sure I would have had the fortitude to do that.
It's incredible.
It's really amazing.
Or
an amazing
vanity.
Decision. Well,
maybe, but you got to have a lot of. It's a complicated thing. It's a lot of things.
That's the point. I mean, there's Edward Snowden's personal psychology and his motivations for doing it, and all that sort of stuff. And it's in terms of the act, it's utterly irrelevant. Like, the important point is, you know, should the government be wiretapping or not without permission? And
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of me sort of feels like, even though I would, you know, I could never be a Julian Assange or an Edward Snowden, nor am I sure I would ever want to have dinner with either of them, but I think we need them.
Yeah, yeah, I do too.
I mean, I think this is a real challenge that, you know, we're facing because, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, yeah, Brian talks about secrecy and all of that sort of stuff, and if you have agents who are operating on the ground and all of that. I mean, you know, there's foreign policy questions here as well, because certainly for a lot of history and really for the last 50 years, you know, the United States has actively interfered in the politics of other countries, trying to, you know, make and break regimes that we thought were helpful to us. And I don't think that policy has worked up particularly well for us. And I think secondly, I think increasingly the international community is not willing to put up with it. I think there's a sort of a real backlash in terms of public opinion internationally about the United States.
But
I would submit
that the United States is at least a country that is, you know, ruled by laws. And, you know, I'd rather have the CIA doing their work than the KGB or what used to be the KGB,
of course,
et cetera, right?
Of course. I mean,
so, and I do think that there's
a
place
for...
But
the point is that if it's a country that's ruled by laws, you know, I mean, America is constantly challenged, and that's always been America's challenge.
Yeah.
At our founding, we set the highest possible standard. And
right.
Even, you know, when they set out all men are created equal and all that sort of stuff, they weren't able to live up to that. And the struggle of American history has been to live up to our principles.
Yeah. That's,
and
yeah.
I think that's the thing is, you know, if you look at, for example, what we did after 9/11, we failed to live up to our principles. You know, they resorted to terrorism, they resorted to violence and all that sort of stuff. And we had the opportunity to operate upon the principle of rule of law, which is fundamental to the United States, and, you know, to really sort of galvanize the international community. I mean, that was a real opportunity. And
There's always a backlash to one extreme. And then there are people within. Look, there are real patriots within, obviously, our intelligence community. And I would say the majority of them are, and our military, who probably agree with everything that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us, I mean, if you really get down to it, they are very aware that we should have a civilian body ruling military.
There's a reason why the military, you know, does not swear allegiance to an individual. They swear allegiance to the Constitution.
That's right. So
it's rule of law. And yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing. I think that's the interesting thing with all of these challenges is that can the ends ever justify the means? And I'm not sure that they really ever can. I mean, there are really extreme circumstances, perhaps, like, you know, Lincoln during the Civil War.
Well, I think, I none of us have really worked for an intelligence agency and been on the ground.
Brian, you've done a little bit of that.
I have. I don't like to talk about it. It's why people are like, why are you so muscular? Well, because I spend a lot of time saving lives. You keep waking up free every morning. I'll keep doing what I do. But no, I did go to Afghanistan, but I with a microphone telling jokes. And I did actually shake hands with some special forces guys, but it's a tough one, man. It is a tough one. I think I don't want to say what it's like to be. I have no idea, honestly, what it's like to put your life in danger like that. Like some of our intelligence operatives, they have a very, very hard job. When something goes wrong, like 9/11, we all turn to them and go, "Hey, where were you guys?" Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work is messy. It's always been that way. You've got to get in there and get information. And sometimes getting information, like one of the biggest mistakes, you know, people say we made was when Clinton no longer allowed our intelligence operatives to associate or pay or work with people from other countries that had nefarious backgrounds. The problem with that is that if you want to catch a bank robber, you talk to other bank robbers. You don't talk to good guys. Like, you know, I don't know a lot of bank robbers. So, we have to be careful with that stuff, but that doesn't mean there isn't something called due process. It doesn't mean that I want to live in a
habeas
country.
Corpus.
I don't want to live in a country that calls kidnapping somebody and taking them to another country where you can torture them extraordinary rendition. I don't like these euphemisms. It didn't make me feel proud. What makes this country great, the United States, is an idea. And I grew up all over the world till I was 14, and I can tell you, mostly in the developing world, and 8 years of which was in the Arab world. And what made the United States and what makes the United States a great country was the idea that people knew inherently that that's where justice lived. That's where the rule of law, it wasn't rule of man. That's where you had a say as an individual. You were protected from majority rule, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Government by the people, for the people, and of the people. And I think those are very important principles. And that's where, that's where the work that you're doing is so important. And it's amazing how vigilant you have to constantly be, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, I think you're absolutely right in that we have all these people that, you know, that are working for good ends. It's, you know, they want to be good Americans. They want to protect America. And so it's really about the checks and balances and the sunshine. I mean, we spend so much time filing Freedom of Information Act requests,
mm-hmm.
you know, just trying to get data about what's going on, because that is how this system works.
Yeah.
I mean, and you're also right. There's a reason why people all over the world want to come to America, because it is the place where they can have their fair shake, where they can say what's on their mind. And we need to make sure that we protect that, but it's tough work.
I'm really surprised at Barack Obama's how hawkish he's been, and how I mean, maybe he just got caught up in a whirlwind of stuff he couldn't control. But you know, it's pretty surprising.
It's hard to know. It does seem to be pretty. It does seem to happen when you get into the Oval Office. Yeah.
And it also does seem to happen when you're not necessarily that popular.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think we have seen over the years that you just never quite know who the person is you've elected until he's been there for a while.
And maybe they don't know themselves, because they get in there and there's so much pressure.
And there's also, I mean, I think that's the other thing too, is you get in that weird Washington bubble and you start to think that it's really easy to lose touch with what most people actually care about.
You're also briefed by your intelligence, you know, the leaders in the intelligence community, and that's where you get your information. So what they decide to not tell you.
I mean, you need someone. I mean, you know, we're not picking a president quite yet, but you need someone who really has principles that are so clear that they're going to be able to. They won't be swayed by whatever comes along.
Good luck with that, Hunter Musk.
Yeah. Well, that's why finance is so important, because I think that's the problem. Is, you know, if you have a system that is about campaign finance, then what you're going to do is select the best fundraiser. And we have selected some amazing fundraisers over the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, that's
you know
right.
what I mean?
That's funny. What's next? What are the other challenges? What do you see yourself doing in the next 10 years? Where does the battle continues? Of course.
Well, that's the really actually awesome part, is that who knows what we're going to be doing in 10 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I started here at EFF 8.5 years ago. And, you know, did I know that I was, you know, going to be, you know, talking about censorship on Twitter, like when I started.
I
like,
know,
no,
it's so weird.
You know? And that's actually, you know, what we're, one of the main things we're interested in protecting, is that idea that something else new can come up. I mean, it is so easy to make fun of the crazy, you know, Silicon Valley startup situation, and I'm as, you know, as guilty as everybody else in doing that. But the way technology changes so fast, you know, I want the cool new tools. I want the, you know, the most awesome thing in my pocket. But we need to make sure that that can be innovated, and that when that happens, you know, the NSA isn't collecting, you know, our every move.
Well, not only the NSA, though. I mean, my God, I was thinking about the Sterling case as you were talking, and this is a guy who had a private conversation in his home, and yet there was no recourse. But, you know, it was, the whole world heard it, and
the jury does not disregard that.
No,
you know? There's no possibility to strike that conversation from the record.
No.
Like,
you're done. You're done.
And, well, I mean, he's fine. He's a billionaire. And
yeah,
he's
but
gonna be,
but I mean, regardless, you know. I mean, it's, you know, whatever, you know, what he said wasn't what I subscribed to and all. But at the end of the day, you know, his privacy was violated in an egregious way.
And I think it raises a really interesting question, which is, you know, I've always thought that the First Amendment is freedom of speech, but the Zeroth Amendment is freedom of thought. And when anything that you say can potentially, you know, be broadcast to the world and can cause you troubles, I mean, it does start to police thought. And maybe there are benefits to that in the sense that, you know, if you go around saying racist crap, then, you know, the world is going to bite back at you.
Yeah, but sometimes you can say racist crap and you don't mean it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you can say a lot of things and you don't mean it. Sometimes you just say something because you're being silly. Mm-hmm. And that's what I worry about. And so, you know, it's not even so much about the NSA. Nowadays, everybody's listening to you. Everybody's got a phone, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and I think you made a really good point about, you know, freedom of thought, which, you know, many legal scholars consider actually part of the First Amendment, not just freedom of speech, but freedom to read and research privately.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of our views have evolved over time.
Absolutely.
All of us have, you know, written something or thought something, you know, had a belief system that, you know, maybe makes us a little ashamed now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, and it's really important that, you know, we be able to explore controversial ideas and accept or reject them. I mean, whether that's...
I mean, look, I remember having a knockdown, drag-out fight. I was 21 or 22, and this girl in my acting school thought it was okay for two gay men to adopt a child. I thought that was outrageous. I was like, what? I mean, I didn't know. I was like, that's a craziest thing. And I really had an argument with her. Well, guess what? I didn't know a lot of gay people. I hadn't been around. I hadn't looked at the alternatives. I hadn't lived a life. It didn't mean I was anti-gay. I wasn't. I naturally never was. I've never been a prejudiced person.
You were just ignorant.
I was just ignorant, and I was trying to protect a kid.
That's
and
right.
And I thought that was the way you did it until I learned, you know, otherwise. So we all evolve, man. We all evolve. You know.
That's right.
Although I will say that my 4-year-old self is right. Like, Play-Doh is delicious.
Well, there is that. Yeah. There is that, sir. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I just worry. And we all do, I guess, that, you know, when you're on your way to evolving and you're on your way to kind of, when you're speaking your mind or you're trying to figure something out verbally, somebody might record a snippet of that and you're in big trouble. Then again, there are people who are real a-holes, like Jean-Paul Gaultier, what's his name, that guy who was talking about gassing Jews. I don't care how drunk you are, you're an a-hole, man. You know, or like Mel Gibson. I guess he's not a racist, but if you get drunk and you're screaming, it's like, dude, come on, man, I've been really drunk and really mad. I don't start screaming about how I want to kill, you know, non-whites. It just... It's not really in me, so maybe you are an asshole. I don't know. Anyway, we're getting off topic.
Yeah,
here.
But
sorry, Rebecca.
I think that's the thing. I think what I've really learned from this is that, you know, it's great to come up with big principles, but the whole point of the legal process is that, you know, if we knew up front what the line was between secrecy and freedom of speech, we would have written that into the Constitution. And case by case, you guys are really challenging these things and figuring it out piece by piece. Which I think is awesome.
Well, Well, thank you. And we're trying to. And I mean, I think, you know, sort of to get back the tent, you know, with what we're going to do over the next 10 years, I mean, we have to, you know, stay nimble and evolve. I mean, part of our mission here is we have like a staff of technologists who basically are doing research about what the next thing is and what we should be worried about it, what we should be worried about before it's a problem. So, it's just, you know, free speech is so important. And I mean, you know, one of the cases we originally did, you know, 10 years ago decided that, helped decide that, that computer code is speech. And so that's just, it's just a really important part of, as we increasingly live our lives digitally.
That makes sense. Well, Rebecca Jeske, thank you so much, for being your work at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks for doing the show. And, I know I learned a lot today, so, keep up the good work. We need you, sister.
Thanks so much. This was a ton of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, man. Come back anytime. All right.
I'd love to.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
That's great.
That was awesome.
Thank you. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. More talk on defending our freedoms, getting to the root of the problem, making big ideas and good ideas accessible here at the BCS.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.